There is an indivisible relationship between authority and responsibility.
That's right. And he, his style was that he would give an individual a task to do, and he would make no inquiry about the task as to how it was going on or what was occurring. He waited for you to report to him as to what was going on in the task, how you were accomplishing it. He didn't expect you to keep on keeping him up to date on every little detail that was taking place with respect to the task, because he had given you the responsibility for it, and along with that responsibility went the authority to do anything that was necessary to reach the objectives that he had placed for you in defining what the job that he wanted you to do. Now, what happens when people don't do the job that was expected of them? And this is an area that I think that Gordon Shrum has been considered by some people to be rather ruthless as to what he would do. But I've never regarded him as being ruthless. He wanted the job to be done. If you appeared to be unable to achieve the job, then what he would do would be to call you in and say, you seem to be pretty busy, that you haven't been able to accomplish this task, and what I'm going to do, I'm going to give so-and-so the job of doing that. Now, what I'd like you to do is to do this other job. The other job is usually a much simpler, straightforward job. He wouldn't scold you, he wouldn't jump up and down. What he would do is to remove the task from you altogether and give you a quite unrelated task to do, which was obviously simpler to look after. And that was his style of administration in the COTC, and I think it's been the style of his administration in everything that he's ever done. The one thing is that he defines the task very well. He gives you parameters to work within the task.
How would he know himself exactly what the task is, so?
Well, I think that this is part of the administrative responsibility of knowing at least what the task ought to achieve. If the administrator isn't able to break down the task to a point where he can define the jobs that need to be done, well, then he isn't a very good administrator.
With the COTC expanding vastly during the war, and all kinds of new problems and tasks must have came up, and I wonder how one could sort of keep it all in his hand,
I think that certainly he was, as we all were much assisted by the professional people that we had with us, whose job mainly is to split up. The whole of the military operation depends on the way you can split up the jobs that need to be done. And the good officer and the poor officer is distinguished, really, by his ability to split up the tasks so that you can get the work done by the least trained people. It's the best user of people's resources, I believe, of any of the human endeavors. The only thing that's close to it is perhaps a hospital organization that tries to use the minimum kind of force in order to accomplish the task that needs to be done. Except that you don't have the same command over people as you do with a military unit.
Do you think Mr. Shrum's and Dr. Shrum's command then was, he was very effective then as an
administrator? He was an extremely effective commanding officer.
How do you think, how did the other officers and everyone in the Corps view him? Was he a dominating presence?
He was a dominating presence. He was a commanding officer, and people recognized him as such. He kept separated from the rest of the unit as a commanding officer ought to. Things begin to change a good deal in the course of the post-war period, but I think that's the chief difference between the unit as it was under Gordon Shrum and Bob Bonner, who were both highly military-oriented people, and they had a separateness from the entire unit. Things begin to change with Johnny McLean, who was a little closer to everybody, but then the unit at the same time was melding into a more uniform kind of unit because everybody was in an officer group by that time. But there was a separation as far as Gordon Shrum was concerned and as far as Bob Bonner was concerned, but they were pretty close to their officers, but not as close to the people being trained as officers.
During the war, there's an obvious need for the COTC and the regular forces to work very closely together because of the supplying officers and immediate relationship. And after the war, I suppose the pressure wasn't quite there, wasn't the same. But I wonder how you did maintain close liaison with the local units after the war.
Yeah, there had always been a very, very close relationship between the COTC and the reserve units. And of course, the reserve units, many of the people there served as replacements in the regular armed forces, even after the war. We tried to maintain a close relationship with the units, and this, in the course of the years after the war, became easier rather than more difficult, because many of the officers of the units were in fact ex-COTC people, and the commanding officers of the various militia units were almost without exception ex-COTC people. And certainly somewhere along the line in the course of the years, each one of the local militia units were at one time commanded by a COTC person. I think that this is without exception, even those on the North Shore as well as the ones here in town. I know it was true of the Irish and the Seaforths and 15th Field Artillery Unit here in town. And this helped to maintain the liaison because we had no difficulty at the smoker, which was held in the fall at the time that we were recruiting on the campus. shortly after the new recruits had decided or indicated their intention to join and may not yet have joined, we'd hold a smoker, at which time we would invite representatives from each one of the militia units and from headquarters as well to come in and meet the prospective recruits. And it helped us in this way, that it allowed us to become acquainted with the potential recruits in a different kind of social setting. We could see how they responded to the new people that they had to meet on that particular occasion. It would give them a chance to look over the armed forces people, and they may decide that it wasn't for them, or they may may strengthen their desire to join up, because it was a purely a voluntary kind of effort, and both parties had to be satisfied in these instances. And it was after that that the real selection process was gone through, and if they succeeded in getting through selection, well, then they would join up.
Were the smoker kept up, smoker tradition?
Oh, pretty well, yes. I can't recall any year in which we didn't have a smoker, and it was really a bang-up party, you know. It was a long party, and one in which a lot of the parlor games of the regiment were performed and this sort of thing, which became quite a tradition with some of the people.
Where were they held?
They were held mainly in the ballroom, the west side room of the mess, and there would be quite a crowd of people, you know, maybe 150 or 200 people. The place was packed with people.
How does it get the name Smokers?
Oh, I don't know. It was, I don't know. It just, I suppose other people have been calling them Smokers. I know that in clubs and this sort of thing, a smoker was an all-male event, and this is really what it was. It was an all-male event, except at the time when the Air Force started to recruit women, and there would be occasional sprinkling of women that began to appear at these when they were joint affairs.
You were the PMC.
Yes.
When were you selected for that?
Well, I can't remember exactly when it was, but I would guess about 1945, certainly within a year of the time that I was formally attached to the COTC.
How are you? Who asked you to become?
Well, the commanding officer asks some officer of in his command to serve in this capacity, and he then becomes responsible for the management of the mess. And it's a fairly frequent thing that the for some reason I'm not sure of, the medical officer is often sort of roped in on that particular task. And although when I was CO, one of my officers was selected, and he was selected largely because he was interested in it and did a darn good job. I think this is the It's sort of a semi-thankless job. You've got all the arranging to do, and if you, it's a matter of keeping track of all the details associated with the social life of the unit.
How long were you in charge of the mess?
Until I became CEO.
Until you became CEO.
Yeah.
What exactly does PMC mean?
President of the Mess Committee. And that means that you preside over the mess committee. A mess committee is a regular kind of organizational establishment that you set up. You have a secretary, some elected people that serve two or three committees, your entertainment committee, your special events committee, and this sort of thing. You may have a catering committee. You have a wine selector, people that have a special interest in those particular areas. And they have then the responsibility of the group. The mess committee has the responsibility for the operation of the unit, and the president of the mess committee presides over that committee and takes the total responsibility for the operation of the mess and is responsible to the commanding officer for its operation, which includes finances and everything.
Can you outline some of the major, let's say, routine events of the mess?
Well, I've mentioned the smoker. There would be a spring dance. Another thing that was routine was that every Friday night there was some sort of an event that went on in the course of the academic year. They were sort of informal kind of get-togethers. Then on Saturday nights there would be some kind of an informal dance, a record dance or something like this. But the more or less formal arrangements consisted of the smoker, the a fall dance, the Christmas reception, which was really for the friends of the unit rather than for the entire unit. The mess dinner, which was normally in February or March. The main annual dance of the units.
This would be the one following the inspection, the annual inspection, right?
Yes, yeah. And those were the main events, but the mess was fairly active in terms of people that wanted to use the mess, and any member of the mess who wanted to put on his own, use the facilities for his own gathering of people, as long as the gathering were acceptable, then, and this would be decided by the mess committee, then they could use it because it was their own private club.
What was the purpose of the meetings in February? The meetings of all the commanding officers?
The February, this was at the regular mess dinner of the unit, in which the main purpose of that was to entertain the graduates that were going to be graduating that year. And what took place was they were the special guests, and We also had a lot of army as well as civilian dignitaries there, and it was really their event. It was put on by the unit, at least by the mess, for the graduating class. And this was the first kind of real formal mess dinner that some of the people would have attended, and was run in the style of a formal regimental dinner with the most senior dignitary of the province that we could get, which was usually the lieutenant governor, would come. And everything was laid on, including the mess orchestra, and piped in dignitaries to the head table, and it was black tie event for the civilian people that were there, and formal military clothing for everybody else. And it was part of the education, really. That's the way we looked upon it, part of the education of an officer cadet. He would, if he went on into the regular armed forces or into a militia unit, he would have to attend these kinds of events. And there's a certain decorum and conduct that is expected of people at a formal mess dinner. And this was part of their education, to learn how to conduct themselves in a mess dinner.
Do you recall any special events while you were the president of the mess committee? What kind of special events might be held?
Well, I guess the one special event was that one of the early, let's see, this would have been in 1945. At the time, we were selecting the pictures to decorate the mess. We had, I think I'd mentioned getting the assistance of Charles Scott, who was the head of the Vancouver Art School, and we had pulled together about maybe as many as 30 paintings from various artists around in British Columbia. And we had hung them in the mess. And one of the things that we didn't have was an abstract. Everybody was more or less traditional art. And two or three or four years before that, I had painted an abstract that I had in my lab, stuck on the side of my refrigerator, and Bob Osborne and Bob Bonner and I were talking about this, that we should get an abstract. And I said, well, I'll get you one. So I went over to my lab. It was glued with cellophane tape on the side of my refrigerator, and I took it down, I put a frame around it, and we presented this at the showing as the work of Paul Durand, a refugee French artist in Montreal. And it was really he was one of the first abstractors of art, you see. And this was long, long ago, when abstract was not really all that popular, you see. And it was really funny that that was the first time that that many of the people who were at the dance had been there, including Larry and Margaret McKenzie, the new president of the university. Well, it just so happened that that painting caused the most controversy in the whole, among all the paintings that were there, you see. And it was, you know, once we got into telling the fib about the thing, well, we couldn't very well back out of it, you see. So we returned a lot of the paintings and kept some of them, but this one was kept. And Sherry Walmsley was the regimental, at least the regimental staff officer at that time. And he was in on the hoax, and of course, the two Bobs, Bob Osborne and Bob Bonner. But we were the only four that knew that it was a hoax. And the picture sort of still continued to hang around in the mess, and finally Sherry Walmsley couldn't hold it any longer from the commanding officer, because the commanding officer had made a few remarks about this, and he didn't want to want him to get in too deep. This was Gordon Shrum, you see. So one day he told Gordon about this. And Gordon thought that it was such a huge joke, that so many people had been taken in by this thing, that he decreed that it should be hung forever in the mess, you see. And he used to bring around his arty friends and present this painting, you know, this interesting and valuable painting that they're able to get. And he used to take great delight in this, especially if it were some person who was reputed to have known a great deal about art, because often they would contribute some more biographical material about the artist, who was a purely imaginary person. But he used to find this a great delight to be able to catch somebody up on that.
Would you describe how you acquired the Emily Carr paintings?
Well, I had got acquainted with Ira Dilworth not long after I went out to the university, and he was at that time the person that was in charge of the CBC, with his headquarters in the Hotel Vancouver. And it was at the time that we were looking for these paintings, and he was a longtime friend and subsequently became the biographer of Emily Carr. And he was sort of taking care of her, and she had become quite invalided because of a couple of strokes that she had had. And what he was doing was keeping her going by selling off a few at a time her paintings. And I went down to see him to find out if we could have an opportunity of seeing some of these, because I couldn't commit to buy them right to begin with. And when I dropped into his office in the Hotel Vancouver, he said, well, I just happen to have a couple of paintings here, and they were turned to the wall, and he pulled them around, and they're really very attractive paintings. I had seen a number of Emily Carr's by this time, and thought that she was really a most dynamic painter. And we had those on display at the time that we had this showing, and they were controversial pictures too. The second most controversial pictures that we had in the display, and because there were a lot of people that didn't know Emily Carr in those days, and many people didn't appreciate her as an artist. And however, we decided then that we should acquire these two paintings, and I went down to see Dilworth, and we had a conversation then about price, and he gave them to me for $125 a piece, and this was a lower than usual cost that he was charging. I think he may have been charging $150 or $200 for them at that time. But his argument with himself was that they were going to be seen by young people. They were going into the university. He knew that they were going to be hung in the officers' mess where the officer cadets would be. And it was his interest to see that British Columbians appreciated the work of British Columbia's best artist. And for this reason, we got them for $125 a piece. Now, one of those paintings is the only painting that I am aware of, and I think that Doris Shadbolt is aware of, who has done a study of all of her paintings, that is painted on a linen canvas, because she used to paint on all kinds of things, you know, paper and ordinary wrapping paper and all that kind of really stuff that artists normally would not use. But this is on a perfectly good piece of linen canvas. Just one of those things that you don't expect to see Emily Carr's paintings on, because even the other one is done on a regular cotton canvas and is in good shape. One of the paintings was selected for her retrospective. One of those paintings was selected for her retrospective show that was assembled by Doris Shadbolt and by the Vancouver Art Gallery. It had a tour of Canada, and when it was in Montreal, I received a letter from Reader's Digest asking that they be allowed to reproduce it in the Digest as one of the five best paintings of the in the retrospective show. And that is the Combined Services Trust Fund that is responsible for it, gave them permission to reproduce it, and it was reproduced in the Canadian edition and was subsequently reproduced in the international edition of Reader's Digest. All this is publicity for the picture. At the same time, it's publicity for British Columbia and COTC, and are really were the original owners of the painting.
How many paintings did you acquire?
We got nine paintings, and we spent, of the $1,000 that Gordon Shrum had given me to spend on paintings, we spent $950.
How many Emily Carrs did you collect?
There were two Emily Carrs.
What is their estimated value today?
One of them, I guess, would be somewhere around $35,000, and the other one would be about $45,000.
Where are they now?
They're in the social suite in the faculty club. And there are various other paintings, Jock McDonald and two Leightons, Peter Ustinov, that's in the president's office at the present time. Nan Lawson Cheney was another painting that we had. And Mrs. Bell's painting of the Hollyburn Ridge. And they're really very nice decorative paintings, and we didn't buy them as investments or anything like that. It's just that this is what's happened to the art market.
These are not the, in any way the property of the Army then? They were just, they were...
No, they were bought with non-public COTC monies.
I noticed from one of the photographs of the officers' mess, there was a, showed some excellent furniture.
Yeah.
I wonder how you acquired that.
Yeah, that's Gordon Shrum bought those at auction from the auction of Senator McCrae's estate from Highcroft.